And this is great. You're right. I am so... Hi. I am so absolutely honored to be up here and just chair this meeting. I just thought, how did they ever decide to ask me? If I did, I went crazy. I did. I want to read the anonymity statement first. The principle of personal anonymity at the public level is just as important for the relatives and friends of an alcoholic as it is for the AA member. At the level of press, radio, and TV, all Al-Anons are anonymous. It is the member's choice how anonymous he or she wishes to be with friends, associates, and others. However, there is much broader meaning in the traditions. They stress principles above personalities to assure us that no one will use Al-Anon for profit, prestige, or power. Okay, I'm going to have Becky read us the preamble on the 12 steps.
Hi, my name's Stacy, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon from St. Albans.
Hi.
The suggested Al-Anon preamble. The Al-Anon family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength, and hope in order to solve their common problem. We believe alcoholism is a family illness and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. Al-Anon is not allied with any sect, denomination, political entity, organization, or institution. Does not engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. There are no dues for membership. Al-Anon is self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. Al-Anon has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps, by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics, and by giving understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic. The 12 steps, number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
I want Marcia to read the 12 traditions for us.
My name is Marcia, and I'm a member of the Fairmont Thursday Night Al-Anon group. Hi, everyone. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends upon unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the relatives of alcoholics, when gathered together for mutual aid, may call themselves an Al-Anon family group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or a friend. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting another group or Al-Anon or AA as a whole. Five, each Al-Anon family group has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics. Six, our Al-Anon family groups ought never endorse, finance, or lend our name to any outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. Although a separate entity, we should always cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous. 7, every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Al-Anon 12-step work should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, our groups as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, the Al-Anon family groups have no opinions on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and film. We need guard with special care the anonymity of all AA members. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles above personality.
Okay, we're going to get right on to our speakers here. I just want to thank the committee again for letting me chair this meeting. I'm so glad I get to introduce you all. I swear, I'm honored. I know these two from Charleston, St. Albans, and I know we're in for a treat. But anyways, first speaker we have is Hunter O, and I get to be in a lot of meetings and share with him, and I know we're in for a treat. He's grown to be a good friend of mine, real special, you know, when there's special people to you, how we all become to each other, but, I'm going to turn it over to you, honey, and let's just tell us.
My name is Hunter, and I'm a grateful, recovering Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. The first thing I want to say, and with regard to Sarah's comments a little bit earlier, some of you from Maryland and Virginia and Pennsylvania may have noticed in a recent article in People Magazine that we do have snake handling churches in West Virginia. Did you know that? But what you don't know is that we handle snakes in Al-Anon meetings too. I'd also like to thank Laura for the flowers. They're lovely. I think she thought there should be something special up here since this is where we're having our meeting, so I appreciate that. My sponsor tells me that those of you who watched the Larry King show, that he doesn't believe in God, that he doesn't believe in a higher power. And so they say to him continually, very often they say, what would it take you to believe in a higher power? What would it take to make you believe in a higher power? And he says, well, I would have to see a miracle. Well, I'm here to tell you that you're looking at one today. Because if you don't think it takes someone who has the self-esteem and low image that I had at one time to get up here and speak, who's working their program, you got another spot coming. I was born in Charleston, West Virginia in 1957, and my parents were from Charleston. They were living at St. Albans at that time. And I have to say that the first shock that I can remember, though I can't remember it too well, was the birth of my sister, who I didn't know was coming. And I wouldn't speak to my mother for a while after that, but I did recover. She, my sister is almost as tall as I am now, so she's grown quite a bit since that day. The family climate that I grew up in was, I would say, and especially in the beginning, it was pretty quote-unquote normal. You know, you always say that word, normal. Nobody knows what normal is. My mother told me early on that, and this is typical, that she was the wife of an alcoholic at that point, that she was very anxious for us to grow up so she would have somebody to talk to. Not a lot of conversation, not a lot of communication in the alcoholic home. My dad was somewhat jealous of my sister and I. He seemed to feel threatened that we were there for a long time, and that was a problem early on in the relationship, but he was a good father, And I have to say also that my sister, the major thing I remember about her when she was little was that she always screamed for my mother. No matter what I did, no matter how sorry I was, she always screamed as loud as she could. When we were little, we used to produce plays, and on a small scale, of course. We put together little circuses. We'd have puppet shows, things like that. But the thing that we played the most often was The Wizard of Oz. And the Oz, the stage was set, the front yard was Kansas, and the backyard was the Land of Oz. And when you made it to the backyard, you had really made it. I was always very enthralled by this girl that lived next door who had kind of auburn hair, and I thought, well, you're really the perfect Dorothy. You've got to be Dorothy every time. And my sister always wanted, I was a scarecrow. My sister always wanted to be the dog. So, you know, I thought, you don't want to be the dog. You're a little girl, you know. But she always wouldn't hear of anything else. So I thought, well, you know, I was 4, she was 2, she's young and dumb, let her be the dog. But anyway, so she was Toto. On the weekends in our home, things seemed to fall into a pattern, which progressively got worse as the years went on. When Friday evening came, about 5:30, my dad would get home, and he would bring a toy, one for my sister, one for me, and that was what he gave to us. What he gave to himself was the bottle, and he didn't drink as much at that point, but he certainly did get drunk as early as I can remember, and never was a joy to be around, drunk or sober, quite frankly, but he just wasn't a talkative person, and things got on his nerves, you know. And when he was drinking, things got on his nerves even worse. But he would bring us the toy, and so, as I said, things would get kind of fun as the evening progressed, and there would be arguments and disagreements, and then the next morning, of course, there would be a hangover, but the hangover never lasted too long because started chugging it down, you know, again, and we were over the hangover immediately, kind of like Operation Women have, get over the menopause very quickly. But anyway, the day would go on Saturday, that was when we really had a good time. There was a lot of times violence in our home. And as I say, alcoholism is a progressive disease, and things would get worse, and then they would get worse. And we're talking here back in 1964, so you can imagine where they were, say, in 1978 or something like that. So we had violence. The next day, at that time in West Virginia, you couldn't buy anything to drink on Sunday. So thank God for Sundays, because that was the only day out of the week, ultimately, that we had that was sober. Now you can buy wine, of course. As you know as well as I do, wine or beer, you can get just as drunk on as you can anything else. So we did have Sunday, but as I was saying, these nervous reactions to everything, this bitching, you know, just no matter what it was, if the dog's fur was brown instead of white, then it was wrong. And that's what the kind of things that the alcoholic would pick up on. And both my parents were drinking at that time, and the thing I can remember most of all about that is, and this has to do, I want to say also, that Mark and I and Karen and all these people, we are not Alateens. We are Al-Anons who came to Al-Anon from Alateens. And, but anyway, that's what I was going to say. Well, I go on to something else. The children of alcoholics, in the worst way, need someone who is cool-headed to be an authority. They want someone to take the lead. Now, they're very good at becoming the parent. They're very good at cleaning the house at times. You know, that's the way it was in our situation. We did all that business. We did all those things. We could even take care of minor arguments between the parents. We could even settle some fights. But in the end, we had to have someone take charge. And if you are the sober parent in an alcoholic home, get to Al-Anon, find Al-Anon friends, learn to work the program, because that is what your child needs more than anything else, is someone to be in charge and to be healthy. So, holidays, we've gone from the weekdays to weekends and holidays. Holidays are a mess in the alcoholic home. We never knew what to expect on holidays. The only thing we could hope for was that my mother's sister would come. She did not drink. And that she would come to at least witness whatever might go on. And so in doing so, we were no longer alone. And we had someone to share whatever might happen. And at least we knew that someone knew that we got presents or could see them open or whatever. Now, this is not true every Christmas, and especially was not true in the early years. It became true as time went on. And there are two places my grandmother would come down, but eventually she said, no, she wasn't coming down anymore. She had turned down X number of parties and X number of get-togethers so that she could come with us, and what happened? You know, we didn't do anything. It wasn't us, you know, but that's how the child sees it. You know, we didn't care about your parties. We don't know anything about parties. We just wanted someone to be there. But it was not, you know, it wasn't horrible, but Christmas and Easter are special times, and we all need to have those together with our families. And that's another thing I would say, make those things, make the dinner time, make things like that special to your kids. We always had dinner together no matter what, you know. And you remember these things because as time goes on, the child of the alcoholic tends to forget a lot of the negative things, most of the negative things, and remember the good ones. My grandmother also was a great one to let you know that the problems that her son, my father, mom's husband, was having were our problems, and that we could do something to make things better. If we didn't run around, if we didn't fight, if we didn't play loud, if we didn't do this, if we didn't do that, he would be fine, you know. Don't make your daddy nervous. This is the kind of thing, you know, that we got. And she was always big on doing that. But yet she was a good grandmother. She did all the things grandmothers do. And I love her very much. But she, you know, did tend to do this, which is not unusual for the alcoholic home. Eventually, I'd say around probably the 70s, the early 70s, if not earlier, some kids beg their parents not to get a divorce. I begged my parents to get a divorce. I wanted them to do that worse than anything in the world. Like a spouse of the alcoholic, I thought everything would be fine. And then if my dad wanted to drink, that was fine. If my mom wanted to drink, that was fine too. But yet, they weren't together. You know, I could handle either one of them maybe if I was alone with them, but not together. And I mentioned the house cleaning bit a little bit earlier. I began to feel by the time that I was in junior high that I was indispensable as the keeper of the house. And I had to run around every night and check to make sure that there were no matches that were lit, there were no cigarettes burning, there were the stove wasn't on, all these things that can burn down a house or explode it or whatever, and check that everyone got into bed and if there wasn't anyone lying on the floor with blood on them. So my sister didn't feel this responsibility, and I developed a great resentment toward her because she simply would get up and call her friends and leave at the slightest sign that the bottle was on the way, which it always was, but she always planned her getaway and did very well at that. She stayed away quite a bit during a lot of the drinking, but that's not to say that she wasn't there, and perhaps that's best because she tended to let her emotions fly quite a bit more than I did. By the time I was in junior high also, I had developed this passion for certain shows on TV. I totally escaped into what was going on in the television set. Certain shows I watched daily, and that was where, how I would remove myself. It was as if I could walk into the TV set and be in there, you know. When I was 11 years old, a big change came. A friend of the family who were in Al-Anon and AA came and talked to my mom and talked to her about Al-Anon, talked to her about Alateen. And mom told me, she said, there's something called Alateen, which you can be involved in, that you would probably enjoy going to. It would be good for you. I think you should go. So I started going at age 11, which is a year earlier than usual, but I needed it, so I went. There wasn't a free Alateen at that time. So in Alateen meetings, I found that there were other people in the world who had these things. Other people in the world had fathers who abused their family in one way or another, whether it was emotionally or physically, that things were not all peachy in the world. There were other children in the world who did have these problems. And a shock to me later on in my life was when I realized that my sponsor at this time in my life, I went to school with her children, never dreamed, you know, never had any idea that they could have a problem of alcoholism in their home. It was totally the farthest thing from my mind. And so that was very good for me. But at that time, they weren't in the program. And so, as I was saying, Alateen was a huge, huge help to me. But I had an excellent sponsor. The group had an excellent sponsor. And after about a year, she had to move away. And I hated to see her go. And then after that, one thing another happened. I lost my ride, and so I ended up not going to Alateen after about a year's time. I never, ever forgot what I learned in Alateen. Never. And it was so helpful to me. Don't ever think that your child is too young to learn, because they aren't. And if they have preteens, if they have Alateens in your community, send your kids, because they need to be there. Anyway, as I said, I got out of Alateen eventually. At this time also, I had developed two personalities. I had the personality that was at home a lot of times. I was very serious, morose, not a big, you know, not much action. And when I would get to school, I would become the wisecracker, not the wisecracker, but the jokester. I didn't pull pranks, but I was always goofing off and acting silly and stuff like that. And this shows the change that my personality underwent and developed more. I think developed even more, not personality per se, like Sybil, but I had different variations of my personality. I guess we all do, but that was this dramatic change between when I was in school and when I was at home, so forth and so on. At this time in junior high, my self-worth started to plummet. I didn't think I was capable of doing anything. If you looked at me in the face, I was not able to respond to you without being aware of what I was saying. I probably tripped over my speech or whatever because I was so insecure and lacking in confidence all the way. I began to associate grades with self-worth. Something had to take the place. And my grades were okay, but I began to think that was the only thing that made the person. At least it was going to make me was that I made these grades. But then I had this horrible conflict in that at home I wasn't able to study. I had an irregular home life. I wasn't able to concentrate, didn't want to study, but also I had a tremendous fear of failure, which prevented me from working at home and prevented me from working at school. I didn't accomplish what I might have. So another example of what the alcoholic home does to the child. There is something in the school system today which is called a learning disability. Learning disability children don't have a problem with their IQ. They have either emotional problem or physical problem, which prevents them from doing what they could with their mind. And I have decided since that time I did have an emotional learning disability. It was a fear of failure, yes, but I wasn't even able to concentrate when the pressure was on, you see. And so a learning disability is another thing that came from my alcoholic background. When I got to senior high school, I had been in a band and chorus in junior high, but when I got to senior high school, I found that I enjoyed music very much. I had two excellent music teachers, and I leaned toward vocal music. That eventually came my love. But you see, I used to escape into the TV, and now I was escaping into music, which at least I had an active part then, you see. And things began to look up a little bit for me. I could sing, and that gave me a feeling of confidence. Music was a great time for me to release my tension, which I did very well. And I never felt like I was a self-pitying type, so that if I could channel my emotions into a certain thing like music, then I was doing pretty well, and I was able to do that. And that was where my strength was in high school. But there was a lady, this vocal music teacher I mentioned, who used to have temper tantrums. Not bad ones, and they weren't over the music like some music teachers, but she would have a bad experience or whatever. And one day she just up and walked out, left the classroom, didn't come back. You know, you don't think of things like that happening when you're in high school, but this one did. And people, she was excellent, but people would put her down for that. And, you know, in my mind I was thinking, my God, she's an immensely talented person, she's fun, and so she has a bad day, at least she's sober, you know? At least she doesn't come to class drunk. And so, but anyway, this person was responsible for my becoming involved in music. When I got to college, I knew right away what I wanted to be was a music teacher. And that I thought I could make it. That just says that I wanted to be a music teacher. And when I got to school, I lived at home. And when I would go to school, I didn't get involved in what was going on there. I was very involved at the church at this time with friends of mine down there, which I had started doing on my own. I had a good time. They were a great source of comfort to me. See, I didn't have Alateen. I didn't have the things that could have really helped me, although this was a great substitute. When I went into college, I felt that I would try it. If I made it, fine. If I didn't, fine. And things went pretty well. I didn't have a car. I caught rides. I didn't have an easy time in college, but I didn't have a particularly rough time either. I got a grant because my father was unemployed for approximately 10 years in that time period. I was able to do reasonably well. And by the time I was a senior, I did my senior recital, I was in this program. And I can tell you this much, if it hadn't been for Al-Anon, I never would have been able to fight that. I never would have been able to get in there and do the things that I needed to do for that recital. Al-Anon gave me the strength. But before I get into that, I would like to say that in November of 78, there is a woman in St. Albans, who I mentioned earlier, tracked me down, had heard that I had alcoholism in the home. So she arranged a meeting at the church where she was sitting across the table from me. And so she just happened to mention in passing that she had this disease in her home and this program that she was in. And so the first thing, she was talking to someone else, you know, it was all very on the up and up. I didn't know I was being baited. And so I said to her after, you know, I had a chance to talk to her, I said, what disease do you mean? As if, you know, I didn't have any idea. I did have an idea. And she said, alcoholism. I said, oh, I know what that's like. I said, I have that in my family too. And she said, well, why don't you come to Al-Anon with me? And so I said, well, why not? I've tried everything else I felt like I had at that time. You know, I guess people can go on for years and years and years and let this go. But I really needed, I wanted something at that point. So I was a very willing candidate for Al-Anon. And when I went to Al-Anon, I liked everybody there. Everybody had what I needed, I thought. They had things like confidence. They had a smile on their face. They were happy to see me. God knows I was happy to see them. They were very congenial. They were accepting of me. Whatever I said in the meeting was fine. They did not put me down. And I'm here to tell you right now, if there's somebody who's sick in your meetings, don't give them a heavy hand. I mean, if they need your love more than anything else, they need the love that comes from this program. And then everything else is secondary. Everything else, I think, works out. If you're willing to get the program, you'll get it. And these people who want it, they need your love. Al-Anon taught me how to practice things which I had heard all of my life. I had heard things that I heard in Al-Anon, but I've heard them in day-to-day living, you know. You hear things like, well, you hear the Serenity Prayer quoted. You hear, don't project, don't worry about the future, you know, don't project. You hear that. You hear, keep it simple. Why complicate it? It's actually a very simple thing, but people don't. You know, they don't do it, so you think, well, who does do it? You know, who really employs these things? The Serenity Prayer became the greatest thing in my life at that time. The word, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. What does that really mean? If you can accept what's in front of you and not let it blow your cool, then look how much further ahead of you are. The courage to change the things you can. Well, that took a little bit longer. That was a little bit broader path. That was a little bit deeper concept. I had to change some things, but what I had to learn was that I didn't need to change other things. I needed to change this thing. This was the only thing. This is the only person that I could change. And if my mother and father never chose to go to AA in their life, if they never chose to be sober, then that was the way it was. I had to accept that. I could not change that. All I could do was work this program. And I tried. I worked it. I was told constantly the only thing you can do is show what this program has to offer. Maybe they'll want it. And I was in the program, go back just a little second to say that my father was unemployed, my mother in the midst of alcoholism, in the midst of every whatever happening that happened in our home, she was able to go back to school and get her nursing certificate, which was a big thing to do, a very big, and is a very strong lady to this day. I'm very proud of her. What I did, the first year I was here at the conference, if you remember, any of you were in the rap session that I was in, all I could say was, but there seems like there should be something I can say, something that I can do that's going to trigger them into this somehow. 2 years after I had been in the program, before I even knew what had happened, my mother had called the hospital, packed her bags, signed in at the hospital, was there. I never even knew it. I found out at school that she was in treatment. I had, you know, it wasn't me, it was her. But hopefully I was able to not give her any negative feedback. One of the things we learn in Al-Anon. But learning these things, living them, producing them, making them come true, living and let living, let somebody else live, and you live your own life, all those things that you hear all of your life, in Al-Anon, you learn how to do it. You learn how to make this happen to you. Other people in the world don't have that luxury, and I'm very grateful. Also, when my mother got sobriety, we had already been living apart from my father, and eventually I moved out into my own apartment because I had graduated from college, and I eventually ultimately returned to the same school, the same music department, different teacher. And there had been another teacher in between the two of us, and she had very different ideas and what have you, and I thought, gee whiz, how am I going to stand this? They climb the walls, they do this, they do that. But the program got me through. The program is good for anything in your life. You can beat anything in this program. But at that time, it was easy to say, "You fool, what made you ever think that you could do this anyway? What made you ever think that you could be a music teacher?" You know, it would have been so easy to say that. It would have been so easy to crumble, to fall. And my sponsor and I'd get on the horn, you know, and back and forth, and I'd tell her this, and she'd tell me that, and pulled me through. This program has pulled me through. And so I want to read this one little thing, and then I'm going to quit. But the biggest, this is from the poem anyway. How many of you have ever read it? No? Well, it starts out with, "People are unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Love them anyway." And so after each verse, it says, "Love them anyway, do it anyway, whatever." But the thing that's on here that stuck in my mind, never noticed it before, the biggest people with the biggest ideas can be shot down with the smallest, by the smallest people with the smallest mind. And then it says, "Think big anyway." So I'm very happy to say that at this time in my life, I have many gratitudes. I have this program, which is wonderful, which has saved my life. I have all my Al-Anon friends, many of them are sitting right here, all through this room. I have my music, and I have my life. And the only thing that I have to do to keep all this is to pray for knowledge of my higher power's will for my life and the power to carry that out. Thank you.
I can't talk into this thing now. And on behalf of the conference committee, there's a gift for you.
Thank you for having me.